Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Yeah, all right. Listen, folks, we got so much expertise on this show, you're not going to believe it. We got all the wine folks who are here to help us. David Hubble has finished tearing apart his house. He has indeed found the sacred Louisiana family secret citrus recipe. He's going to share it with us a little bit later on. Doesn't have as much detail about how to do it, but that's why we got Dan on here. And also Jim is sending me this beautiful picture of what the wine people like to call a carboy. Am I got that right, Dan? A carboy, yep. a three gallon carboy of Satsuma wine. Still a little cloudy, but he'll rack it up, and he says that's gonna filter out. It is really beautiful. One of the things you may have missed in our last conversation, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about many things this morning, and you feel free to call us because that's the way we make this Sunday morning work. We get to answer your questions, but we decided we were going to talk a little bit with all of this citrus out there, oranges and satsumas and my beautiful clementines, all of these great citrus out there. What can we make a wine out of it? And indeed, we can make a wine out of it. And Dan is telling me, when he describes this thing that he's looking for out of the citrus wine, it's bright, it's bubbly, it's sparkling, it's champagne-like. Now, champagne has a particular, it has restrictions on how we can use the term, but that's the quality we're looking for, is like a sparkling wine, rather than some kind of deep, if you're imagining a deep muscadine wine. That's not what citrus wine produces, right, Dan?
Right, and I want to be careful because you're not necessarily going to get a carbonation in the wine. That's actually, yep. There's a specific process you have to kind of go through to get carbonation in the final bottles of the wine that you're making. And it kind of has to do with, killing the fermentation process down to a certain level, but not totally killing it like you want to in most wines. Right. So it's not necessarily that, I know you're saying champagne and because that's how it's going to have that bright flavor, but I know a lot of people kind of think of, carbonated wine when they think of a champagne or a Prosecco or some sort of sparkling, and it's not necessarily right. going to be carbonated. It just has that brighter, more acidic, fresher taste that you're going to find more right. in like a drier champagne or Prosecco style drink than you will in, let's say, like a Pinot Noir or a Merlot, something that's more red right. and has more intense mouthfeel to it.
So let me ask you this. If you wanted to give it that kind of more of a sparkling wine character with the actual carbonation, you can add the carbonation to it. Is that fairly easy to do?
There are people that will tell you, and let me just step. I am not a winemaking expert. I am a hobbyist. I've made quite a few batches. Some of them have been really good. Some have been not so good. I'm still learning a lot. But as far as the process of putting carbonation in my final bottles, that is not something that I have attempted. Simply because if you do it the wrong way, you can make miniature pressurized gas bombs, and that can be a bit of a hazard at times. So I have not fooled with it personally. But from what I understand, as long as you get the ratios of the ingredients correct, it's not super difficult to do. So it can be done. It basically, I don't want to get ahead of myself.
That's good. So let's start with the basics of your thoughts on making a citrus wine. just some of the basics. Where do we start?
Well, I think the best way to start is just to talk about the winemaking process in general.
Yeah.
Citrus wine has some distinct characteristics that come along with it. Most have to do with the high levels of citric acid in a citrus fruit and how that can affect the outcome of the fermentation process and the final flavor of your wine. And I can kind of come back to those as we get to them. But in terms of just the winemaking process, and is it Jim is the one that's also...
Jim, yeah. Jim in Georgetown,
so
yeah.
He's already kind of opened up the floor here is with a carboy, right? So that is your secondary fermentation container in a carboy. So like when you start out when you want to make a wine and understand that wine traditionally inherently refers to grapes because grapes have the four necessary components that make up a wine: acidity, tannin, sugar, and I want to say they actually back in the grapes in the old world had natural yeasts on them, so you didn't actually have to add yeast to grapes whenever you
went
to ferment them.
And they have but, they have yeast on them here too. It just may not be the yeast you want. So yes,
right. And so then that is, you know, a traditional wine is going to have grapes with it. But then there's also what people call fruit wine or country wine that you can make with, you know, any other fruit. Because all that you have to do to make alcohol is have a sugar and add yeast to it. And through that process in a environment without oxygen, the yeast will convert the sugar to alcohol. So what you want to do is pick out a fruit. You know, I think around here, some of the best ones to start out with are blueberries or blackberries, or in this case, you know, Satsumas.
Yep.
And you're going to need a few things. You need a primary fermentation container. Usually a 5-gallon bucket works fine. You need airlocks for the primary fermentation container. You need a secondary fermentation container, which is usually going to be your carboy. That usually looks like a glass demijohn or like a one of those Kenwood or Abita Springs water jugs, except, you know,
that's
glass.
That's what it reminds me of. That's right.
Right. You need that. You need an airlock for that. You'll need a long, you know, kitchen-type utensil, like a wooden spoon or something to stir with. You need something to siphon the wine, which, you know, the most common thing people use is called a racking cane. It's basically just a tube with a smaller tube inside of it that you pull up and press down. And whenever you have the you know, container liquid on at a higher level and you start the siphon, it'll siphon down, you know, people know how siphoning works, like gravity.
Right.
Works to pull the liquid down to the other container. And you're also going to need, and this is, you don't have to have this. This is maybe getting a little more technical into it, but something to read your specific gravity. it is called, the name of it is leaving me right now, a hydrometer.
Yeah.
A hydrometer in order to read the specific gravity of your wine.
So, right. Do you get this stuff from a? I mean, do you get? Can you get a standard wine making kit to do this with? Do they sell them in kits?
Absolutely. You can find them on Amazon, and there's actually a guy. I think I mentioned it last time we talked about it. There's actually a guy in town, off of Moffett Road, kind of over near. Heading out toward Pathway Church, heading down 98. He's called the Winesmith, and he has anything and everything you could need out there. It's a great place to go to get started with some of the stuff you need.
So this is just for our listeners, and I think this is what the big takeaway here is. And I'm listening to this because I'm curious too as to how all this works. And I the last time I made wine, as I said, I was 11 years old, and I made it in a plastic milk jug and I stuffed it in a drawer. And my mother found it, and it was nasty, and it was probably good. She probably saved me from something really. It wouldn't have killed me, but I probably would rather have died. So it's okay. So I'm learning from this, but here's the thing: the Winesmith on Moffett Road. Is that right? That's the name of the shop, the Winesmith.
Yes, sir.
Yep. It is a great place to go if you need this equipment, and he can set you up. He's a really great guy. I've heard from several people. He can really set you up with this equipment, and there's not that much of it. There's a few specialized things you need, but there's not that much of it. And you get this stuff, and you can make some really great wine. And this is the introduction. We're going to be back with Dan. I got to take a break. Because it's that time. Charlie, isn't it that time? Yeah, it's more than past time. So we're going to take a break, but we're going to be right back with a little bit more about wine.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Well, look at this. We're back. We got Dan. We've been talking a little bit. We've been talking a lot about how to make citrus wine because there's lots of folks with citrus out there right now. They're wondering what to do with all of it, I suspect. A lot of people had a great citrus crop this year. Someone sent me a picture of a citrus and said, "What kind of citrus is this?" And I can sometimes tell when you send me a picture. In this case, I don't have enough information in the picture to tell you, except that one thing I'll say is it looks like a rootstock. It doesn't look like the kind of citrus that is going to be particularly good to eat. It may be edible, but I emphasize the word may. It may be edible like a cat is edible, which is not something you want to do. It won't kill you, but it may not be pleasant from anybody's perspective. So it, I don't know that picture of that citrus. It looks a lot like a rootstock. It may be Cleopatra, and I can keep looking to see what kind of rootstock. Just for my entertainment, it won't make much difference to you. I don't think it's going to be very good. You can take the fruit, you can cut it open, and tell me what you think. It's probably going to be very tart. Very tart. Maybe syrupy sweet and a little tart, or mostly tart and a little syrupy sweet. But I don't think it's going to be a great one. Hey, Dan. So, yo, have you made a citrus wine before?
So, I have not done a citrus wine. I actually have the Satsumas in the freezer right now, ready for them to go. And my carboys are full of blueberry and a blueberry honey melomel. And I've got to get those racked out so I can actually have room to make the citrus wine. But I've been preparing for it. Funnily enough, so whenever y'all started talking about it on the show the other day, I was like, "Oh, I've been researching this."
Yeah, so I got Jim's recipe, and he's got he talked a little bit about how to make it, and we gave the ingredients earlier, and I'm sure you didn't write it all down, but it sounds really good. He's got the cane sugar, he's got the 60 Satsumas, pectic enzyme, tannins. The oak chips, which he's adding, he likes to do that. And are you going to add oak chips to yours, or are you going to do it without the oak chips?
I'll probably do it without the oak chips. Are you using the oak chips sort of like a stave in the secondary part of the process, kind of just to add flavor to it?
So I'm looking at this. I'm looking at sugar. Close with towel. I don't know when he's using it. He's using it as far as oak chips go, and what you want each time you rack. Every time you rack the must is how he's using the oak chips. They won't travel through the siphon, as he points out.
Right.
And he only uses it if you want an oak barrel flavor, which is going to add a little bit of a vanilla quality to it, which, you know, I don't know if I would want that necessarily in my citrus wine or not. So that's an interesting thing. Hey,
David. And that's all personal preference. There's a lot of little tricks like that you can do with wine and as you're racking it, you know, from container to container.
Yeah. So David's going to join us. David Hubble's going to join us, Dan. David, you there?
Yes, I'm there.
So what a collection of experts here. And David, tell us a little bit about David found his secret recipe. Tell me a little bit about that recipe from Louisiana, David.
Okay. Let me know if you can hear me well. The recipe comes from my grandmother's older brother, Guy Sanji, who was a World War II veteran who started a orange grove down in Port Sulphur, Louisiana, back after the war. And he grew all kind of citrus. And sometime along the way, he started getting into orange wine that they would make down there. It's very popular in Paris. Follow me?
Yeah, we can barely hear you, David.
Okay, I may have to try another phone. If you want me to call back in a second.
Why don't you call back on another phone, because that one's getting pretty fuzzy.
All right, let me do that in a minute.
Yeah, we're going to be back. Dan, any particular advice on yeast that you would offer for the types of yeast for this this wine, or just general use yeast?
Yeah, so let me see what I've got right here. I know there's a couple different companies. I'm a big fan of Lauvin. It's a company that makes some particular wine yeast, and there's one I've got right here called 71B-1122 that I used for my blueberry wine.
Mm-hmm.
I know with most country or fruit wines, you want to use something closer to a champagne yeast.
Yeah.
Because typically those yeasts, I can't remember the reason, but I know they'll survive longer in a higher alcohol environment. Because usually where your alcohol level comes from, is, you know, yeast can only survive in a solution with alcohol at so many parts per million. So once your alcohol level usually gets up to like 12%, the yeast will die off and the fermentation process stops.
Right. And in this case, you got a lot of sugars, and the yeast is going to have to dissolve a lot of sugar in this to get it down, I suspect. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah, that's right. You're going to have a lot more sugar from a fruit wine than you will from just grapes.
Right. Right.
Like blueberries, blackberries, even satsumas are going to have a lot more sugar in them than just a traditional, you know, grape must.
Right. So that's why we're looking at a specific kind of yeast and kind of a champagne yeast. The yeast that Jim recommends is EC118. I don't know what that means. I'm sorry, EC1118. EC1118, it looks like. I don't know what that means, but I assume it's kind of a champagne yeast.
Kind of, they're almost like names. It's just like the names for the particular strain of yeast.
Yeah,
that some of these companies kind of trademark, and if he says EC1118 is a good one, then I'll absolutely take his word for it, and I'll get some of that to you.
Yeah, yeah. David is back with us, and I'm thinking we're going to hear him better. David, say something.
Can you hear me now?
Oh man, that's good.
Okay.
So
I didn't want to interrupt what you were in the middle of, so let me know when you want me to start the...
No, it's good. This is good. So we kind of got to the point you were talking a little bit about Port Sulphur, and there were lots of orange groves. Do you know what were they growing in those orange groves? Do you happen to know the variety? This is for me, for my interest.
I think they were growing Louisiana sweets, or I don't know if that's the same as Hamblin oranges.
Yeah, good. That's what I predicted.
I think
Louisiana sweets.
And really like to get the navel oranges from down there, too. I guess they're the Washington navels from...
Probably
Lake Washington.
That's probably true. And
he also had satsumas and grapefruit. I know that they have like an orange festival down there in Plaquemine Parish, and there's a lot of popular, I guess, wine. Orange wines are very popular down there, obviously with the abundance of oranges.
Yeah. So so tell me a little bit about this recipe. Have you been listening to some of our other recipes? Anything noticeably different about your recipe?
Yes, I'm kind of wondering now because I've never made this. I just got my cousin to comment on this about a year ago when some of the other family members were interested in it. But what I see an absence of is any type of yeast or any of the other type of additives that were discussed. This one's
mostly
juice, water, and sugar.
Isn't that interesting? So they're using, Dan, you hearing that? They're using wild yeast.
That's wild.
Well, that is wild.
Interesting is they would take whiskey barrels from Martin Wine Cellars in New Orleans that they were selling, and he would do all the fermentation in the barrel.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big thing in some wines. I know you'll use the whiskey barrels as your secondary fermentation container, and that'll kind of do the same thing as like what Bill was talking about. You know, adding the oak chips to it kind of just gives a little more body, a little more complexity to the wine.
Yeah. Ooh, that's wild, David. So basically, he just is looking at Satsuma juice. Did he talk about Satsuma zest at all?
No, he was just using the Louisiana sweet juice.
I'm sorry. Did he talk about the orange zest and orange juice?
All she mentioned was 18 gallons of juice, 18 gallons of water, and 25 pounds of sugar. And he would dissolve the sugar into the water and then have the juice in the barrel. And then just mix it and then put the fermentation tubes and all that in there and just let it go from, I guess, February till about August. I mean, October when it stopped, or whenever it stopped bubbling, and he would leave it in there until the following fall.
Wow. That's cool. And you know, it's interesting to me that they're just using a wild yeast. Whatever yeast, as Dan said, that was like they used to use the yeast on the grape. They used whatever wild yeast apparently was out there, it apparently worked out okay. Obviously worked out okay. I would be tempted to use the zest. Charlie, am I talking too long? I got to take a break. I'm enjoying this too much. We got to take another break, and we're going to be back. And this is a lot of fun. This conversation. I hope y'all can hold on for just a little bit till we come back. Charlie.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town. Me and Lillian. Just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, look at here. We got a lot of folks talking about wine this morning. I'm trying to get to everybody, but we got a caller, Charlie, a question about a citrus Robbie, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, buddy. Yeah, I'm the one that sent the picture in.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Listen, that particular citrus is about the size of a 50 cent.
The size of a what now? Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Tell me, I couldn't hear. It's the size of a, how big is it?
Like a 50 cent piece. It's very small.
Oh, the fruit is the size of, yeah.
And it's quite sweet. It's not ripe yet, but it's quite sweet.
And the rind is hard, or the rind is kind of soft?
And squeezed on the rind, and the pulp just popped right out. It's got large seeds in it, but it is quite good.
And the rind is thin, or is it thick?
It's fairly thin. It's real thin, actually. You know, it's real slick and thin.
Well, do you have any idea how long that tree has been there?
No, I don't. My next-door neighbors they're recently deceased, and we were over trying to help get it ready to sell, and I discovered it in the backyard, and I've never seen anything quite like it. It's amazing, actually. And I said, well, I'm going to at least try it. And so I took out my pocket knife and cut one half in two. And I was squeezing on it to try to just get some juice out. And the whole interior just popped out. And I, you know, took some of the seeds out, put it in my mouth, and tasted it quite sweet.
Yeah.
And I could tell it's not ripe yet. It's still some green. And where it is in a very low light area, and it's grown up fairly spindly. But it has probably 100 fruit on it.
Yeah, so, I don't know. It could be a Kyushu, K-Y-U-S-H-U, which is kind of hard to find. I think that's how you spell it. Kyushu, which is not, it'd be really hard to find it. It could be some kind of kumquat, but I'm not quite sure.
Kumquats I'm real familiar with, and the ones that grow in the area. My wife and I, we've made marmalade and what have you. But this one is just totally different.
There's some funky kumquats out there, and they don't look like the ones we're familiar with.
Oh, really?
I'll take a look at it and see what we can find. Do some of the leaves have a little bit of lobes on them? Do they have little points at various places on the leaves?
I did not notice that. They're slick and very shiny, you know, and actually a beautiful little plant.
Yeah, okay.
It's about 12 foot tall.
Yeah, so let me look around, see what I can find. I'm gonna look at that picture a little more closely with a magnifying glass, and call me back next week and see what I can come up with. Okay.
I'd be glad to, yeah, because I'd like to know what it is. But like I said, it's quite sweet and it's quite good.
All right,
it's
great.
It's real sweet.
Yeah. Let me look it up. We'll see what we can find.
All right. Have a great day. Okay, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. So,
bye-bye.
Yeah, so Jim has sent me a message. We've been talking about wines, and we've got some very patient folks here this morning, David Hubble and Dan, who is they're both talking about wines. And Jim from Georgetown, who's monitoring this very closely, who got us all started on this with his Satsuma wine recipe. And Jim says, yeah, the EC1118 is basically a champagne yeast, a campaign yeast, as he says, which I think actually the words are closely related, champagne and campaign. He says he uses that for meads as well. And as Jim says, with the wild yeast, you don't necessarily end up with the same wine each time. And that's probably true, but, you know, there probably was a fairly predictable yeast out on those citrus in those grows that David Hubble's family used to use to make wine. David, any other thoughts about that wine from Louisiana?
No, I mean, I never had the opportunity to try it. I was too young to drink it back then, and but the family members who had it had good memories of it. So, I mean, I think it turned out pretty well, obviously. You know, I think he probably did at least a 30 or 40 year period of time.
Yeah, and there are some good wines that people don't have any memories of, which is one of the problems with wines, of course. But the that's very good. So they had good memories. One thing about wild yeast, and I will pass this along. I do understand this much. Is that wild yeast vary from place to place pretty dramatically. One of the interesting things, of course, when making great ales in Holland and in the Flemish countries, Belgium, is that they would open the doors to the brewery, just open the windows, and let whatever yeast come in when they were ready to collect it, and they would collect that yeast from the countryside. If you did that in Mobile, you'd get something pretty nasty as a result, more than likely. So you have to be a little careful with the wild yeast. But in this case, given the time of year, it may be the time of year, and the fact that these groves were these huge, monotonous groves with nothing that they had a very specific kind of yeast that was easy to capture. That's very interesting. Dan, any thoughts on whether you have ever tried a wild yeast?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever tried a wild yeast yourself, Dan?
Oh, no, sir. Nope. not that patient, I don't think.
Yeah. And patience being the fact that you would have to make lots of mistakes, meaning you'd make lots of mistakes?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, there's a couple different ways to do it. You could either depend upon the natural yeast that's growing on the surface of the fruit that you're using. Mm-hmm. you know, with grapes, it's usually not that big of a problem. With a citrus, that's going to be more difficult to do because for a citrus wine, you're not going to use the whole fruit like you would with a grape. with a grape, you know, you put the grape in, crush it, you know, you see the old depictions of the women barefoot and the wooden half barrels crushing grapes, and that's how you would make the must. But when you're doing a citrus wine, you're actually going to want to juice the fruit and maybe, you know, take a spoon and scrape out some of the pulp, but you don't want to get any pith in the must. You don't want to get any seeds in there either because that can add bitterness.
Yeah.
And the reason that's important in terms of yeast is because usually your yeast is going to be growing on the surface of the fruit that you're using.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So if you're not putting the skin into the must, you know, with the juice, obviously you're not going to have the yeast.
I wonder if the zest itself may actually have the yeast embodied.
Right, and so if you're using the zest, that's kind of how I was thinking is they're probably going to do it. If you're using the zest, that would be
that's what I was thinking. So, David, if you do this, you're probably going to have the peel with it, and that's something they didn't write into the recipe, but
right.
I think you'd have to do that at some point. Now, Jim in Georgetown, let me say that Jim is adding to our discussion and making our lives much more complicated because Jim is now sending me pictures of the bananas that he is saving to make wine. He's going to make a wine recipe with bananas, which is just, I'm not laughing, Jim. I've never thought of bananas making wine. What a remarkable thought. Banana wine. That's interesting.
There are actually recipes with the camellia flowers.
Now that sounds interesting.
I made that. Well, I can elaborate on making something similar to that. I don't know how much time you got.
Go ahead, David.
The
the one thing that John Folsom, Louisiana, makes is a ratifio, which is basically infusing brandy with fruit or camellia flowers. And so I've done that with satsumas and citrus, where you take that and you get, and you seep it in there, or soak it in there for like 6 weeks to 6 months. And then after that time, you strain it, and then you make a simple syrup, and you add to that, and it makes kind of like an aperitif.
Yeah, yeah, and that sounds really good. I have had banana, how would I describe that? A banana...
liqueur?
Well, yeah. Except it wasn't really liqueur. It was more like a banana brandy would be the best way to describe it. And I will have to say that I don't really think I want another banana brandy. there may be a way to do it. It was funky. I'm not sure, but the camellia brandy that sounds really, really good. We got to take a break, and now Jim is going to jump in on the action. That means all three of us can be on for this last 15-minute segment if I'm not wasting your Sunday morning too much, all four of us. So it'll be fun if y'all can hang on. Let's take this break, and we're going to be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. We're back. We got a little bit of time left. Jim from Georgetown. Jim, you see what you started here?
Isn't it beautiful thing? I heard David talking about a flower type of wine, and I just wanted to mention that any kind of mint that you might have, be it spearmint, wintergreen. I had a chocolate mint plant that wine out of, and it was spectacular.
So it makes me want to use pycnanthema mint from my old wild mint. I got a great one. Ooh, that's good. I wonder if I could collect enough to actually do anything with, but that would be interesting. So
it takes about 4 cups for a gallon.
Oh, it's not too bad. That's not too bad. So this is really, really interesting stuff we've been talking about this morning. And Jim has got, Jim's got a whole bunch of processes here. Jim, any comments on what you've heard from us so far about the recipes and the making it? It seems like Jim is using the same, we're all basically talking about the same kind of yeast. Everybody agrees on that. Except that David's folks apparently used a wild yeast, or maybe they just thought it was beside the point to mention that you need to add yeast. I don't know. But any thoughts about?
There's really nothing the matter with wild yeast. You got to expect it to be either different every time, or if you happen to get it the same, it's not a problem.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Is it possible that the wild yeast could make it too funky?
Could make it what?
Too funky. Too not very good.
No. So the yeast shouldn't have an effect on the flavor of it. The wild yeast. The thing you'd be concerned with would be other bacteria or microorganisms contaminating the must, and maybe making it go bad.
Just be the wild bacteria on the peel or something like that.
Yeah, pretty much. That's the reason why I always use a Camden tablet to begin with. It kills all the wild yeast on it, and then you put your own yeast.
I see.
Right.
So,
I'm interested now in contacting my cousin to find out if they use any additional yeast, because you got me wondering now if I ever try it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's an important thing to know, and I'm very curious, David. So you're going to have to get back with us about that as to whether they actually used wild yeast. you know, and a lot of cultures do use the wild yeast and just open the windows, literally. And obviously that's what happened in Italy with some of the traditional wines there. There was probably some variability. You would think that a lot of only certain types of bacteria would survive the winemaking process when your alcohol levels are getting up to 19 or 20% at some point.
That plus the fact that you boil your water and you put your boiling water in over your fruit and your sugar and all that.
Yeah.
I didn't think bacteria could really live in boiling water situation.
Yeah, and that would so well. These are all really interesting questions that I don't have any answers to at all. That's why I have you guys on here. But so the wild yeast was the big wild card in all of this today. But boy, what we agreed is, and Jim keeps challenging us with all these things. So Jim, I'm not going to be the first to taste the banana wine, but I want to hear how it turns out. The mulberry wine is interesting if you can get enough mulberry. Jim also sent a recipe for persimmon. Yeah, and I think it could be. The persimmon wine is also very interesting, and there could be a lot of variability in that depending on the types of persimmons you used. Jim, are you using a native persimmon or are you using a Japanese persimmon?
Japanese right now. I've planted a native persimmon, so I'll let you know in 5 years what that tastes like.
Yeah, that's right. Well, native persimmons have a really great flavor, and I think they would be better. And I think that, you know, talking about all the ingredients being there, the tannins, they are right. A little sweet, but I actually think the American persimmons might make a better wine. American persimmons were known for making the first beers in North America were often made with persimmons. So I don't know what that means for wines, but that in itself is very interesting.
Well, the persimmon last batch that I made ended up being like a fine, dry white wine.
Oh, that's
interesting. Very light, very light.
Isn't that interesting? That's not what you would anticipate, is it? But that's fascinating.
Hey, I have a question for Jim.
Huh?
On this citrus wine recipe you've got, I know as far as the process goes, after the primary fermentation, or I guess actually before the primary fermentation, when you're making your bust, do you add anything like for mouthfeel, like a red grape juice concentrate, or like, you know, say a few pounds of raisins?
You can use raisins. I use tannin because it's just easier. You know, But yeah, you could definitely do raisins if you didn't want to do that. For the 4 gallons that I made, I would use probably three and a half cups of raisins.
Okay.
You know, chop them up and all that, and you know, make sure they're opened up. Don't just throw them in there. But
right, but I'm kind of trying to decide how I'm going to approach that. You use the tannin concentrate, the powder.
Right. Once again, yeah. Available at the
Winesmith. Yeah, you know, tannins, folks, for our listeners, tannins are the things that make your mouth pucker when you eat an unripe persimmon. But tannins are actually really useful for a lot of things. They can actually be really good and add a lot of flavor if they're in the right quantities. And that's what they're talking about here.
That was one of the caveats with citrus wine is without the natural tannin in you can kind of get a watery taste, a watery consistency to the wine. Mm-hmm. And in order to add the proper mouthfeel, like Jim was saying, that you would get from like a wine, kind of whenever you take a small sip, it feels like you feel it all through your mouth. You want to add a tannin.
Yep. So we're going to have to, folks, this has been really good. This is interesting. This is fascinating. I want to keep talking about this, except nobody's going to let me do it because we got to take a break here for our big break until next week. Hey, Jim, thanks for starting this.
Thanks, Bill.
Dan, thanks for giving us all your background. And David, thanks for raising these interesting new questions. We're going to have to follow up with this pretty soon. This has been a great little show. Had a lot of fun. Thank you all for
participating. I appreciate it, Bill. David, Jim.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's get together again. This is fun. Hey, we're going to have to coming up on a break here. There it is. We'll be back next week.
See the curtains hanging in the window in the evening on a Friday night. Little light is shining through the window. Let me know everything's all right. Summer breeze makes me feel fine. Blowing through the jasmine in my mind. Summer breeze makes me feel fine. Blowing through the jasmine in my mind. The paper laying on the sidewalk, a little music from the house next door. So I walk on up to the doorstep, through the screen and across the floor.